From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. After a day of silence on Twitter, this morning President Trump responded to yesterday's testimony by fired FBI Director James Comey, tweeting, "Despite so many false statements and lies, total and complete vindication, and wow, Comey is a leaker." Democratic House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi responded on MSNBC that she's concerned about Trump's fitness for office after testimony that he pressured Comey to stop an investigation. And she suggested Trump needed more sleep. It's the day after the most anticipated Senate testimony in a long time, but this week also saw an upset vote in Britain, the U.S. House vote to remove many aspects of Dodd-Frank. Oh, and this was Infrastructure Week, so let's now go to our weekly political roundtable.
And joining us today, Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And Ayesha Roscoe, White House correspondent at Reuters. Hi, Ayesha.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And Rick, let me start with you. 24 hours or so after the Comey testimony and all that we've seen since then, what's the impact of this? Is it the game changer that people thought it would be?
It's a signal moment in the history of this president and perhaps of the presidency. The former FBI director directly accusing the president of the United States of lying, of manipulating, of trying to co-opt him and get special treatment. But we're seeing the reaction fall a lot where people thought they would come in. No huge enough bombshell to really change perceptions that we know of. And we're seeing an aggressive attempt now to undermine James Comey. The fact is, though, you have the fact is that both of these men can't be telling the truth. Someone's lying, either the president of the United States or the former director of the FBI. That's extraordinary.
Ayesha, what's your takeaway from it?
Well, it seems like for now, President Trump is taking the position that this is kind of vindicated him. It's almost as if, and Donald Trump Jr. said this last night, this is over now, and so now we can just move forward. I think that that's probably not going to be the case because, as was said earlier, even though Comey did say that President Trump was not under investigation when he was at the Bureau, he did accuse the president of lying. And so that issue is not going to go away. And this issue of whether what President Trump did to Comey amounts to obstruction, that's not going away either. So I think that this is just kind of like the beginning of a very long process.
Well, you know, I want to ask both of you, because many analysts also said that was then that he wasn't under investigation. He may be now. So, Rick, let's take up the president's tweet this morning that he was vindicated. Comey did say yesterday that President Trump never said to him to entirely stop the Russia investigation, but Comey was firm that Trump said he hoped Comey would stop one aspect of the investigation, the part that was investigating Michael Flynn. So your thoughts?
I think there's an irony here in his ouster of Comey is that on the day that James Comey was fired, President Trump could say that he was not under investigation. Today, he cannot say that. His aides cannot say that because the investigation has expanded. It's now in Bob Mueller's court. And yes, there are aspects of what President Trump has said that are backed up by Director Comey, specifically the three assurances that he was not under investigation. And as you mentioned, no direct action to say you have to end this investigation. However, there's a big caveat here, which is the broad case that Director Comey is now presenting to Bob Mueller that potentially could get to obstruction of justice. So the investigation has almost certainly expanded since Director Comey has been fired, and Donald Trump is very likely to be under a lot more legal scrutiny, a lot more legal jeopardy than he was a month ago.
And Ayesha, you were pointing out, you know, this idea of accusing Comey of being the leaker. NPR's learned that Donald Trump's lawyer will file a complaint with the DOJ, the Department of Justice, about Comey admitting that he sat up in the middle of the night, decided to call his friend at Columbia University to send his memoirs to the press. But we also understand the DOJ's inspector general has no power to compel testimony from someone who's no longer there, which, you know, Comey isn't. So what about the Trump campaign and the Trump lawyer trying to now position Comey as a leaker?
Yes, and I guess that politically it seems like that's a strategy that they can do to definitely play to their base to say, look, this wasn't right. He's leaking to the press. That has a very negative connotation. But to take it a step further and to say now we're going to file a complaint, that it also brings more scrutiny onto President Trump, because now there are people who are saying that this is an abuse. Basically, you're retaliating against someone who's was a whistleblower, that you could look at James Comey and say that he was trying to show something that was going on in the government, and he's no longer in the government.
Yeah, I mean,
so
the
punishment for him is unclear. So it's unclear what could really be gained from the complaints, other than kind of some political score, scoring some political points, but it could also backfire on the president.
Let's talk about some of the reaction from members of Congress. And the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, responded to the hearings yesterday and defended the actions of the president in his conversations with Comey. Here's what he had to say.
He's new at government, and so therefore I think that he's learning as he goes, and you now know why he's frustrated, because he was told nothing wrong here, and he wants to get things done for the American people.
Rick, is that good enough for the Speaker of the House to say that the president did this thing that some people believe to be illegal because he's new at government?
I don't think that would fly in a court of law if it happened to one of us. I think he's right, but that's not an excuse. That's not an explanation. And he's got people around him, or should have people around him, that explain what's proper and what's not. And I think from the account of Director Comey delivered under oath yesterday, it's very clear that President Trump knew what he was doing, in the sense of clearing the room, of making these particular conversations, of having very specific talks with Director Comey. He seemed to know exactly what he was doing. And if he didn't know it was improper, I think I have a hard time squaring that. He's the president of the United States. This is not someone that just took over the night shift at McDonald's. You got to learn the practices. You have to learn how the law is governed. So I don't think that's going
to
work.
And by the way, I think that probably taking over the night shift at McDonald's is hard.
No offense to the people who work the night shift at McDonald's.
Right. But you've got a policy manual even there.
Right. But Aisha, take up this notion that nothing else is getting covered or maybe even done. Healthcare, tax cuts. The president declared this infrastructure week. He's out talking about it today, but I'm not sure that really was able to get through. What is this doing to the Trump presidency?
Well, it's hurting them from getting their message out. I mean, the staff and the aides, I guess, are saying that they're just powering through and that they are going to, you know, focus on the president's agenda. But clearly, there's no way that this is not a distraction. Now, I guess the Senate is moving ahead with some things on health care, and maybe they'll get a vote on that soon.
Although Senator Lindsey Graham came out this week and said he doesn't think there's going to be a health care bill passed this year. That's a Republican.
Yeah, and so they have that. But what it also has done is it hasn't really given the president time to sell these policies. I mean, he's done some talking on infrastructure this week, but because everyone's so focused on Comey, there's not really much airtime for him to be selling why he's, you know, his take on health care, his take on tax reform. So this is stopping them from being able to make their case to the American public on anything else other than, you know, I'm not under investigation for Russia. So that can't really be a good week for the White House.
One thing that they did do this week, and this is the Republican House, they passed the Financial Choice Act, they're calling it, which undoes a lot of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law that was passed in the wake of the financial crisis to stop another financial crisis from happening. That was passed in 2010. So we're talking about it took 7 years for the Congress to decide that they didn't want all of those things that people felt were necessary to prevent another crisis. Rick, do you think, first of all, that this is going to make it through the Senate and put us at risk of another financial crisis?
It's a fascinating development because I think it speaks to a few things. One is that for all the talk of the stalled agenda, there are still things the president can do. Now, your question, the Senate is going to take this up and have a much different take, but the direction of less regulation is real and it is happening and it will continue to happen even in the midst of this, even with the rest of the agenda essentially paralyzed, stalled. There will be things that happen. Second, I think it speaks to the disconnect between the big story that we're all covering and what goes on in much of the country. The fact is that these financial regulations have been seen as something holding back small businesses. So to the extent that you agree with the Trump agenda, there are a lot of people that are going to be celebrating this in the business community.
Yeah, well, there was another big news, seismic news yesterday out of Britain, that British Prime Minister Theresa May, who decided to call a vote to sort of confirm the support that she had in going ahead in the Brexit negotiations, really lost that vote in that she lost seats in Parliament. She's got to come up with a new government. What is this? You know, draw a line, Rick, if you would, from Brexit to the U.S. Is there one?
There is. First, I think that the United States doesn't have a a monopoly on dumb politicians, because this was a dumb political move to call this vote. But secondly, and I think more relevant, we're seeing this churn in our politics, and it is going back and forth. And you can't capture the sentiment and say there's a populist center-right or right-wing movement that's sweeping the world. People aren't sure what they want. And
right.
I think you're seeing a kind of crazy gyration in either direction.
Well, because I think it's amazing. I mean, it's counterintuitive. In Britain, they've just had two major attacks. You'd think that people would flock to the polls to vote for the conservative, which is what people usually do for security reasons after attacks. They didn't.
That's exactly right. And I think that you're seeing just a much different direction and now a government that's going to be in chaos for some time, even as they try to unwind from Brexit.
That's Rick Klein, political director at ABC News, and Ayesha Roscoe, White House correspondent at Reuters. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
The UK is dealing with another unexpected election result, with Prime Minister Theresa May losing seats in Parliament after an election that she called. In France, newly elected French President Emmanuel Macron faces another hurdle if he wants to revolutionize the country, as he promised. Macron must win a majority in the French Parliament in legislative elections this month. As of today, his brand new party has no seats at all. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Polls show Macron's brand new party is headed for a landslide. Only on rare occasions have French voters not given a legislative majority to the president they've just elected.
Of course, I'm nervous because I'm very conscious of the responsibility that is given to me, that will be given to me if we win. But then I'm also very hopeful and very excited. And the victory of Emmanuel Macron was something that really lifted us all.
I forgot a lot in my English.
Citizen candidates are on the hustings all across France. Republic on the Move has to win 289 out of 577 seats in the National Assembly to hold a majority. Half the new candidates put forth by the party are women. 50% are regular citizens with no political experience. Vendors hawk their wares at an outdoor street market on the other side of Paris. Stan Guarini is shaking hands with shoppers. The entrepreneur who founded a solar panel company is now running for a seat on Macron's ticket.
So I feel like a citizen going for a Congress or Parliament. And this is very important because we want to keep the spirit of a citizen movement. We want to change the country.
Many of the parliamentary races will be extremely tough as the newcomers go up against entrenched opponents from the political establishment. But polls show Macron's party is actually in the lead. Only on rare occasions have French voters not given a legislative majority to the president they've just elected. But this time, the president is starting from zero. English teacher Owen Chiver says he's unlikely to vote for Macron's candidate in his district, but he admits the new president has totally shaken up the system.
The divide between right and left has just exploded. It is no longer valid. And now we don't know where we're going. We don't know what's going to happen exactly. We're going to see.
The candidate in Paris's 19th arrondissement is Mounir Majoubi. Majoubi became a kind of star during the campaign when he led Macron's bare-bones digital team and foiled suspected Russian hackers. He's now been put in charge of a newly created digital affairs ministry. At 33, the son of Moroccan immigrants is the youngest member of Macron's cabinet.
When you grew up in a poor family in a rich town, first you feel very grateful to the country and to the city. I had the best schools, I had the best universities, I had everything, and I didn't pay for it because the state was there to help my family. And now I believe I can be useful to others as well.
Majoubi wants to help Macron build a dynamic economy that he says will allow strivers with dreams to succeed, but also protect those who need help. 60-year-old Jean-Pierre Numa has come out to one of Majoubi's campaign events. He says Majoubi and Macron represent the new face of France.
Il est jeune, comme de nombreux membres de l'équipe de Monsieur Macron.
They are young and from diverse backgrounds, he says. They symbolize this multicultural nation that is part of a globalized world. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Well, Bill Maher will be back on HBO tonight for the first time since he used a racial slur during his interview with Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse last week.
I've got to get to Nebraska more.
You're welcome. We'd love to have you work in the fields with us.
Work in the fields?
That's part of that.
senator. I'm a house. No, it's a joke.
Well, Maher faced calls for his resignation. HBO called the comment inexcusable. Maher apologized. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is with us. And Eric, what was your reaction to that comment?
My concern when I go to judge this stuff as a media critic is I want to look at somebody's pattern of behavior. Because if somebody says something one time or makes one mistake, that's one thing. And I think that's mostly forgivable. It would have to be incredibly awful for a one-time transgression to merit losing your job. But when you're looking at somebody like Bill Maher, this is a person who has a pattern of talking in troubling ways about gender, about sexual orientation, about the Muslim faith in particular, and about race. And black folks have had a hard time with the way he talks about race for a long time. This is not the first time he said the N-word on television, and this is not the first time that he's shown that he has a cavalier attitude about some of the strictures that we have accepted as a society about how we talk about race, particularly about who says the N-word and what conditions under which it might be acceptable.
Well, what do you make of his explanation and his apology?
I think he's saying what he has to say for HBO, number one. 22% of their audience is black. So they can't have somebody hosting a signature show on their air who's perceived to be racist. So he had to apologize. But this is also somebody who has kind of resisted some of these strictures that I mentioned earlier and been cavalier about it. I mean, I always feel like if you're going to challenge these ideas, if you're going to challenge how we use the N-word, then you have to do it in a way that is thoughtful and have some sense that there's some thought behind what you're doing. To just toss out an offhand joke that not only uses the N-word but also references slavery at the same time, that to me suggests that you're not really respecting the ground that you're treading on. You're not respecting how precarious it is or how important it is to get it right.
Well, what do you think about what Wesley Morris wrote about this in the New York Times that, quote, firing Bill Maher would be too easy. Real time is the sort of laboratory where just this sort of problem is talked or shouted out. It would be fascinating to see him in the next episode, if there is one, surrounded by a cast of characters who have castigated him for Friday's scandalette. He may not learn a lesson, but there would be a lesson in that, too. We've been not learning that one for centuries.
I mean, I love Wesley Morris, but I think in this case, that's just a really flowery way of saying we should criticize him for what he did and then shrug our shoulders and accept that he might do it again. You know, I don't really buy this idea that we just have to accept that this is a guy who occasionally says things that are racist or sexist or Islamophobic. When I hear people use the term politically incorrect about stuff, to me, too often, that is just a code for saying, I don't want to take into account the values and the concerns of people who are not like me. And so I want to talk about this issue in a way where I don't have to think about how women feel about it, or I don't have to think about how people of color feel about it, or I don't have to think about how Muslims feel about it. But media is a platform where all kinds of prejudices can be exacerbated, they can be reinforced, they can be validated. And it's important to challenge that kind of stuff wherever it comes up, because otherwise you never get it out of the society.
Eric, tonight, Bill Maher will have the rapper Ice Cube and sociologist and writer Michael Eric Dyson on the show. He was going to have Senator Al Franken, but he canceled after what happened last week. What are you expecting from the show tonight?
Well, it'll be interesting because Michael Eric Dyson and Ice Cube, of course, are figures who are not known for holding their tongue, and they are guys who are known for calling out prejudice and racism wherever they see it. But they're also friendly with Bill Maher. And if this is a situation where two of his buddies are co-signing what he did and accepting the apology that he put out without really examining the real issues behind why people are upset, then that's going to be a missed opportunity. So we'll see if Maher is willing to subject himself to the same kind of scrutiny that he regularly subjects other people to.
This did not happen in a vacuum, and in fact, it happened not long after another incident where a comedian went too far, and that would be Kathy Griffin, who stirred up the controversy by tweeting a photo of herself holding a prop that looked like President Trump's severed head. Now, Griffin quickly apologized, but she lost a lot of gigs. CNN dropped her as the host of its New Year's Eve program. Here's how she reacted to that.
There's a bunch of old white guys trying to silence me. And I'm just here to say that's wrong. You don't have to like me, but you shouldn't silence a comic.
What do you think about this in the context of what happened with Kathy Griffin and the questions of what goes over the line and what is the point at which somebody does something that they have to be taken off the air forever?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. You have a right to free speech. You do not have a right to an endorsement deal with a TV show on CNN. When you're a performer, you're going to these companies and you're saying my brand and what I stand for and how I talk about things will enhance your brand in some way. If you do something that so horrifies most of the general public that these other brands don't want to be associated with you, that's not hampering your free speech. That's these brands deciding, you know what, in the marketplace of ideas, your brand is toxic and I don't want to be associated with you. That's freedom of speech as well. Ultimately, we have not had the kind of wide-ranging discussion about what these terms mean and how they echo stereotypes and prejudice. And, you know, I always felt like black folks are, we're trying to figure out how we feel about the N-word. We're trying to figure out what it means to us. And some of that is generational. I think a lot of young people feel like they have reclaimed the word in a way that older generations don't believe and don't accept. But the, so there's a vigorous debate going on in the black community about how to use this word. So to be a white person to try and, or not even try, but accidentally stumble into that conversation is a precarious situation. And to me, I just feel like unless you want to run the risk of being thought of as being racist, why don't you just stay away from that conversation and let black folks figure it out? And then we'll let you know how it turns out. And then we'll all move forward from there.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
It was a snowy winter in California. So snowy that some California ski resorts are staying open for business much longer than usual. Squaw Valley is staying open at least through July 4th. And Mammoth Mountain will stay open into August, something it's only done once before in 1995. Joining us via Skype is Lauren Burke from Mammoth Mountain. Lauren, welcome.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, and a lot of snow this year. How much is left at this point?
So right now, we have 100 inches of snow at our base lodge, which is 8,900 feet. And at the summit, we have a base of 250 inches. So there is still so much snow out here. It's really hard to believe, but it still looks like it could be wintertime.
And that's enough snow that you know at this point that it's going to last you through August? You'll be able to keep the mountain open through August?
So we're in a pretty rare position where we're at such a high elevation. You know, our mountain sits higher than every resort basically in Tahoe. So our snowpack holds up a lot longer. And while we have 20 feet of snow at the summit, there are pockets of snow around the mountain that we've measured up to 40 feet. And that really holds up for a long time, a lot longer than we expect. And even if we stop skiing in August, I bet when you're looking up the mountain in September, October, or before next season starts, you're still seeing a lot of snow up there.
And just to remind people, I mean, California's been in a drought for years until this year. What month did you close in the previous years?
Typically, we close around Memorial Day. We do have one of the longest seasons in the country. We do operate mountain biking on the mountain as well, so it is finding a balance between winter operations and summer operations. But typically, we open early November, close around Memorial Day, and then lead into bike park season. But this season, you could be skiing down a run, and you'll have people loading up their bikes biking down next to you. It's going to be crazy.
So how many people are coming this late in the season to ski at Mammoth?
We just had one of our strongest Memorial Day weekends of all time in terms of skier visits up here. They've heard about the season that we've had, and they really want to come and do something that they've never done before, which can be skiing in June, July, even August now. So we see people come up here. They ski for an hour in the morning. They go hit golf course in the afternoon, and you kind of get the best of both worlds.
Are all the runs open right now?
No. So we have about 70 runs open and 6 chairlifts are running right now. But it's the most terrain in the country that you can ride. And the conditions, like I said, are still so good. If you get out there mid-morning, you're going to be having a blast. And you don't have to deal with the nonsense of winter where people are skiing in, you know, 10-degree weather with 5-foot snowstorms. It's the best.
I will say there is a scary run at Mammoth. I'm sure there are much scarier runs for skiers who are much better than I am. But the Cornice Bowl, I wonder how that is right now.
Cornice Bowl is going strong. It gets groomed every night, and that's definitely a favorite run of a lot of our guests. It's kind of a rite of passage to skiing off the summit. So it is a prime spring skiing run right now.
I tried to go slowly down there. It's just not possible. You just have to get into it on that Cornice Bowl, go over the cliff, and just make your way down.
Dropping in is the hardest part.
Lauren Burke, yes. Of Mammoth Mountain, thanks so much and enjoy the summer skiing.
Yeah, of course. Have a good one.
It's here and now. The Tony Awards are this Sunday, and Natasha and Pierre in The Great Comet of 1812 leads all comers with 12 nominations, including two for stars Josh Groban and Danae Benton, who, along with a sprawling cast, transport the audience to 19th century Russia. Last fall, when Natasha and Pierre were still in previews, we visited the show's home, Broadway's Imperial Theater, which has been transformed into a Russian cabaret. It's The show's creator, playwright and composer Dave Malloy, decided to model the stage on a cafe he discovered while traveling in Moscow. Patrons like him sat alongside musicians.
And the entire place was packed with people. Everyone had vodka and dumplings on the table, and everyone had these little shakers on the table, these handmade shakers, and so everyone was shaking along with this music. Yeah, it was during the middle of that evening when I was like, oh, this is the place that Natasha Pierre and The Great Comet of 1812 should happen. Like, this is the world that we want to live in.
So we had our shakers. In the audience, we were handed little egg-shaped shakers to play along with orchestra members scattered throughout the house. As the story unfolds, Napoleon's army is on the outskirts of Moscow. In the city, frantic, vodka-soaked carousing, affairs, angst. It's based on 70 pages of Tolstoy's War and Peace. And we're told at the outset, it gets complicated. Consult your program.
This is on your program. You are at the
When I first read the book, these 70 pages really sang out to me immediately, in that there were these kind of these two couples, and a lot of times musicals will have like kind of two romantic couples, like the lead romantic couple and then like the funny couple. And in this show, there was Natasha and Anatole, and they were kind of like the lead sexy romantic couple. And then the other couple was Pierre and God, or Pierre and his existential life crisis. And I loved that kind of subversion of the form.
He also threw out other theater conventions. The actors run up wooden stairs to the balcony. We were part of the audience that was actually sitting at cafe tables on stage, right under star Josh Groban's nose. Here's director Rachel Chavkin.
It just became clear that there was going to be no stage, or that everywhere would be the stage.
Did you worry that those who were not on the stage would either feel distracted by the people on the stage or feel jealous that, wait, I'm not on the stage, looking up Josh Groban's nose?
Well, I think the biggest concern was just maintaining a sense of intimacy for everyone. And so for those people that couldn't be on the stage, we had to, in effect, bring the stage to them.
Light burst into the room, and I saw rise, and I saw smile, and the world opened wide.
The show stars Danae Benton as Natasha.
And I catch my breath, and I laugh and blush, and I hear guitars.
And recording star Josh Groban as Pierre, both in their Broadway debuts.
I die in my sleep. They say we are asleep until we fall.
Look out.
Hello. Hi.
After the show, we visited Josh and his ferocious, actually not at all guard dog, the equally famous to fans, Wheaton Terrier Sweeney.
And who's this?
This is Sweeney.
Hi, Sweeney. We've got a little puppy here.
Demon puppy of Fleet Street.
And tried to describe sitting on stage a foot underneath Josh as he performed.
I don't know how to describe that I actually
felt your breath and I could see in your nose.
Yeah, that's I don't know. You either get what you pay for or you want a refund after that. But we certainly get up close and personal with everybody.
I want to talk about that, but just being on stage. Now, you are a superstar. Yes. And you have performed for thousands at a time.
Yes.
But what's it like to be in that ensemble?
It's unlike anything I've experienced in my career, and I've done a lot of things. To be a cog in this beautiful wheel and to not have to be a solo, but to be part of a team of so many people, many of which are making their debuts along with me in this show that we all love so much. We can't wait to walk through the stage door and leave our troubles behind us each day.
Just a little bit more on that. Because members of the audience are sitting on the stage, I mean, my heart was racing to be surrounded by people exalting, grieving at one point. Mm-hmm. There was an actress sitting, we were knocking knees, yeah, and she was sobbing.
Yeah. Oh, it's incredible. No two shows are the same for us. You know, to have new faces and new spirits in the room that are interacting with us, and that was the X factor that we couldn't wait for, because that educates us as to how we continue our scene, how we do our solos.
Talk about your character, Pierre. We understand that you have performed in a play before.
Yes. I mean, I was a theater student, and then I got plucked into this world of recorded music, and it's something I've missed so, so very much. And I haven't donned a beard and gone out and sung theater songs since I was Tevye and at the age of 17. So
Fiddler.
And Fiddler. So it's a lifelong dream come true, for sure.
So two things there. There's hope for all the Tevyes in their high school productions.
Oh, yeah.
Right now.
If you're a high school Tevye, I didn't even start as Tevye. I was originally Perchik, and then I worked my way up to Tevye. So even if you're a high school Perchik, you can eventually find yourself on the Broadway boards.
But tell me about inhabiting Pierre, a broken man, an alcoholic, a slumped shoulders. You're Josh Groban, and things are going pretty well for you. So
yeah, we all have sometimes the questions, the existential questions that Pierre has, especially right now. I think a lot of people are questioning things, and there's a sadness to Pierre that is understandable because of where he is socially. And he knows his wife doesn't love him. Pierre is just full of inner turmoil.
I was struck when you were singing one of the big numbers. It's the one, there was a beautiful line.
Did I squander my divinity? Was happiness within me the whole time? Yeah, Dust and Ashes, great song.
Did I squander my divinity? Was happiness within me the whole time? They say we are asleep until we fall in love. We are children of dark.
I was struck by how there might have been a raised, clenched fist to the sky or a bitten knuckle or a hand to the forehead as this character agonized. And you did hardly anything physical.
We did make a conscious decision for much of those kinds of songs to keep it as internal as possible, that if you sing it with honesty and you think it with intensity, that it will come across. And that was a great, very freeing lesson for me.
Look, you're Josh Groban, as it turns out.
Yeah.
Stunning voice.
Thank you.
But you're on Broadway. You know, the Broadway crowd, they sacrifice a lot. Mm-hmm. They don't make a lot. You know, they're like these gypsies in many ways. And yet they're some of the most talented people.
Without question.
Do you ever find yourself thinking, wow?
I say wow all the time, this whole show.
Anatole is hot. He spends his money on women and wine.
We left Josh after Sweeney gently gnawed on producer Karen's jacket.
He didn't do any damage
to
it. I will say, my dog is so funny. He's like a toddler. Notice me, notice me, notice me. He plays with his toy that he didn't care about all day long. He goes and finds him. Maybe I'll just go sniff in the trash.
Surely they've come to interview me. Back in the theater, Natasha and Pierre and the Comet of 1812 creator David Malloy and director Rachel Chavkin look exhausted. It's the weekend before opening night. Well, are you both feeling, David and Rachel, that, you know, perhaps, I mean, I don't know if Josh Groban will attract anyone to Broadway, but that perhaps you have a hit on your hands?
I mean, who knows? We'll find out soon.
Yeah, I just keep touching. I touch wood a lot. I'm very superstitious.
Stands people of art.
They needn't have worried. Days later, Natasha and Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812 opened to rave reviews and is now up for 12 Tony Awards. We spoke with Rachel Chavkin, Dave Malloy, and Josh Groban last November. The Tony Awards are this Sunday. It's Here and Now.
Today is day 5 of the Bill Cosby trial. The actor is accused of drugging and sexually assaulting Andrea Constand, a now 44-year-old massage therapist from Toronto who testified on the stand this week. The incident allegedly took place at Mr. Cosby's home near Philadelphia in 2004 while Constand was running operations for the Temple University women's basketball team. Of the dozens of women who have stepped forward in the last few years to accuse Cosby of similar attacks, this is the only one to go to trial. Joining us for the latest on this is Laura Benshoff, reporter at Here and Now, contributor WHYY in Philadelphia. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Jeremy.
So let's start with the accuser here, Andrea Constand, who faced 2 days of questioning on the stand. What did we get from that?
Well, Andrea Constand hasn't talked to the press. She's a witness in the case, but we had a lot of time to observe her during about the 7 or so hours she spent on the witness stand over the course of 2 days. And more than half of that time was cross-examination when Cosby's attorneys were grilling her, and they really zeroed in on a few details from before and after the alleged assault. Things like the volume of phone calls that she had placed to Cosby following the alleged assault, and also some dinners, you know, private dinners that she and Cosby had had before the alleged assault, and that they continually try to characterize as romantic. But throughout that, you know, watching Andrea Constand, this striking 6-foot-tall former basketball player who's got this enormous gravity-defying mane of dark brown hair, she had a kind of zen about her, a calm. She did get a little emotional at times when talking about the alleged assault, but she never broke down, and the defense asked her very, very repetitive questions, possibly to try to pierce that calm, but they just didn't. And after that wrapped up, after her testimony wrapped up, her civil attorney, Dolores Troiani, who specializes in cases that involve sexual assault, was there, and she had this to say about her client.
I think it takes a lot of guts to do what she did, to come forward in a room filled with people and to be able to maintain her composure and her train of thought even to testify in the manner she did. And we are just very, very proud of her.
Laura, what's the main evidence that they're using against Cosby and how does it relate to the old civil suit?
So in addition to Andrea Constand's testimony, they have this document from when she sued Cosby civilly in 2005. Initially, investigators at local police here in suburban Philadelphia decided they weren't going to press charges, so she took him to civil court. And for that suit, he gave sworn testimony over 4 days. There's hundreds of pages of it. But that testimony was sealed until a local Associated Press reporter pushed for its release. That was in 2015. And that testimony not only contains his side of the night of the alleged assault in detail, but in it, Cosby says that in the past he had purchased Quaaludes to give women he wanted to have sex with. And prosecutors hope that will help seal their case, that will help show that he had a pattern and intended to incapacitate her. That's what they'd like to show.
Now, Cosby's wife has not been in attendance, but he has had other supporters with him in court this week, right?
That's right. Camille Cosby has not come to the Montgomery County Courthouse, but there has been kind of a little parade of various entertainers and comedians who've known Cosby throughout his decades-long career. And if you have spoken to the press afterwards just saying, come out and support Mr. Cosby, the most high-profile person to come was Keisha Knight Pulliam, who played the youngest daughter on The Cosby Show, Rudy Huxtable. On the very first day of trial, she walked in linking arms with him and was photographed doing that.
The judge in this case has told jurors to ignore anything they've heard outside of the trial, but I'm thinking in such a high-profile case, is that going to be possible?
Well, they really tried to pick people who didn't have a preconceived notion. First of all, jury selection, I think, was pretty intense. And you know, their phones are monitored. They're not supposed to watch TV or use the internet. And the press has been chided repeatedly not to even think about making an attempt to contact them. And we're even barred from kind of looking down the hallway where they walk very briefly to their break room.
We're hearing now, Laura, that the trial could be over sooner than expected. Is that right?
Yes. It's possible. The judge said at the outset he was expecting a two-week trial, but earlier this week he says that we're moving at such a fast clip that things could end, you know, in a week and a half. And he might even hold court on Saturday to make that happen.
And what are the possible outcomes for Cosby?
Well, it's not likely that there will be more criminal cases he would face. You know, the statute of limitations prevents older sexual assault accusations from being brought to trial. So this is the only one that's resulted in charges. You know, depending on how it goes, Cosby could walk free if his lawyers introduce enough doubt about whether the encounter was consensual. Or if he is found guilty, the sentencing guidelines show up to 10 years behind bars.
That's Laura Benshoff, a reporter at Here and Now contributor WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Bill Cosby trial. Laura, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And later today on All Things Considered, when two NPR journalists were killed last year in Afghanistan while on assignment, it looked like it was a random attack. An NPR investigation reveals the convoy they were in was specifically targeted because of the presence of Americans. That story later on All Things Considered. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.